offering. My most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind. And we are joining you live from our studios for this week's continuation of the satsang that we began on the Satya Sai Suprabhatam. This will, of course, be the concluding session of the series. I think we did 3 or 4 episodes. We have 3 or 4 stanzas of the Suprabhatam that we have to complete, which we'll hopefully do today. And with prayers to Swami, we'll be able to complete this that we've taken up. Before that, as always, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem. And Prem, I just can't help smile as I recollect that even in our hostel times, when we would have to get up at 5 a.m. for Suprabhatam, there would be times that we would be, let's confess, we would be grudging about it because we feel that how can you get up so early in the morning and come and all that. So it's not that every one of us every time went happily for Suprabhatam. Of course, today whether we went grudgingly or happily, we are reaping benefits of that Suprabhatam. But there are many times when we would rush in so that we don't miss the Suprabhatam and miss out on the attendance there. So we would be joining in somewhere in the middle of the Suprabhatam or towards the end of the Suprabhatam. Well, not exactly in the same manner, but in a similar fashion. We, dear listeners, we also have another brother joining us in the Suprabhatam today for the last 3 stanzas. And let's welcome Brother Sai Prakash. He will also join us in this satsang, and it's the more the merrier as always. So we will be going through the last 3 stanzas now. We had gone through the first 7 of them last week. I think we concluded with Shrutva Tava Adbhuta Charitra Akhanda Kirtim. So today we will be beginning with Sita Sati Sama Vishuddha Hridumbu Jata. But before we do that, let's invite Brother Sai Prakash also in case he wishes to make any opening statements.
Sai Ram, Sai Ram Prem, Sai Ram Arvind, thank you so much. It's really a delight to be a part of the afternoon satsang. And this is a very interesting topic, Suprabhatam, because in a sense, we have had Suprabhatam for all the avatars and different gods. But this is also one of the ways in which, you know, you revere Swami as an avatar. Like you have Suprabhatam for Lord Rama, then Venkateshwar Suprabhatam and all that. So when you actually chant the Suprabhatam, it's like you're, revering him as the avatar, as Bhagwan himself. This is one way of offering. And Swami has always spoken a lot about the Brahma Murta, which I'm sure you would have discussed in the previous 2 episodes. But there is one point I would like to make, which Swami specifically told in that Satya Sai Anandadai. In the book Satya Sai Anandadai, Swami said, like, if you want to withdraw money from a bank, you need to have money in your account. And he said, so you can put that money and you can, you know, earmark it for different things, like a fixed deposit or recurring deposit or your regular savings account, and you can withdraw money from that. But Swami said, any spiritual effort, any effort done in the early hours of Brahma Murta, that punya is earmarked for your spiritual growth.
Aha.
So he says that all effort that you do in the Brahma Murta, Swami will earmark it, he'll put it aside, it's spiritual growth account.
Wow.
So he says, so everything that you do in the early hours of the morning, so Suprabhatam, which Omkaram and Suprabhatam, which we do in the Brahma Murtam, if you do it regularly, all the punyam that you get from that is earmarked for your spiritual growth.
By punyam, of course, you mean merit. And yes. I think that is possibly the reason why another perspective of why we call it Brahma Muhurta, because that Muhurta or that time period is when all the activities, all the good that we do go towards realization of Brahman, maybe. I mean, because that's what you said,
right,
that any other merit that we do can be used for worldly gains or worldly prayers, health, relationships, career. But the Brahma Muhurta Punyam is earmarked. It won't be touched. It is a corpus, like, you know, almost like a provident fund it is. A provident fund, when we are working, when we see it getting, I mean, that is a practice in India. I'm sure that is a practice in many other countries also. We see on a monthly basis, as the salary comes in, a part of it is cut away. And we feel deprived of that amount. And we feel, what is this? But all those who have retired say that this is the nest egg. This is the one that comes as a great comfort once you retire. I think that is how the efforts that we put in spiritually during the Brahma Muhurta is, we may feel, what is this, get up morning, we may feel a little uncomfortable, but when the time comes, when we are face to face with that ultimate moment, we will see that it is these efforts that have mattered the most.
And talking about Brahma Muhurtam, usually they say the Brahma Muhurtam starts at around 4 o'clock. And we always see that a lot of people who take to spiritual sadhana would start at 3, 3.30. You know, there's that beautiful video where Swami is explaining about the hostel schedule.
Yes.
Sitting in Trai Vrindavan.
Right.
And so very sweetly, you know, one thing is, here we are singing what is called the awakening hymn, or the song which you sing to awaken him. But in those few minutes, Swami describes the scene in the hostel before the Suprabhatam. And Swami would say that they come, they won't even brush their teeth. Some people run to the bathroom, they brush their teeth, and with the brush and the toothpaste in their pocket, they come to the Suprabhatam. And then they come there, and then they cover with a blanket, and they sleep. Especially in Vrindavan, early mornings used to be really cold.
Right.
That we had to go to the Suprabhatam with our blankets. It used to be so cold. And Swami would say that some fellows will sit there and sleep off. And the beauty is, after that, Swami says that, you know, he speaks about Brahma Muhurtam and how important that time is between 4 to 8. And then very lovingly, Swami says, 4 is too early. You don't have to get up so early. Get up at 4.30. It is good enough. Study for some time and then come for Suprabhatam. You know, Swami said it is a very useful time that early in the morning. You know, so much of concession. And, you know, all this to reward us. Right. He gets nothing out of it. He says, do this, win my grace, and then I'll come and reward you when you need it. And it's so very beautiful that it's one thing, I think, even when we used to be part of the Shravanam Varnam, one point which we always used to keep saying is, it was so sweet that here was the Swami whom we were, you know, completely in the Dvaita Baba trying to impress.
Right.
But always convinced that he was the indweller.
Correct.
Right. And these were the moments where that both sides of that Swami were seen and relished, and we lived with that.
In fact, before you just go on to this paragraph, one more thing which comes to mind is, you know, I think some of the old students in Vrindavan, they have actually discussed about how the schedule was fixed,
right.
Daily schedule was fixed, and I think Swami was sitting on in a chair in the old hostel, that was the car shed. Erstwhile car shed, and which was, you know, kind of modified into the hostel. And Swami went there and he was sitting, and he said, now we have to make a full day's schedule for the boys. And he said, let's start at 4. Swami, please, Swami, too early. 4.30? Okay, 4.30. No, Swami, that is also early. Dunna pata. Okay, let's make it 5. So it's almost as if, you know, Swami was like having, in consultation with students, fixing up the entire schedule. So
the Suprabhatam now is 5.15.
Right.
But even though it's 5.15, you know, anecdotally, you come across so many students who come and tell and come and confess as to how this practice of getting up at 5, 5:15 is so helpful. It has helped them so much in the worldly sense as well, not just spiritually, whether it's their workplace planning or whether it is about family, in every sense. And, you know, to an extent, I feel even some of us, you know, sometimes it gets late because of work or possibly watching an exciting cricket match, you know, whatever. Even at such times, I think because of this regular attendance of Suprabhatam, not many of us are able to, you know, sleep through the day. I see in my circles, in many places where people are able to sleep till, say, 11:30 in the morning, 12 in the afternoon.
Oh.
But somehow, you know, however late I sleep, even I have tried it out, even if I sleep sometimes like 1:30 a.m., somehow just can't sleep beyond 7 a.m. And I really feel that this is because of the regular practice of getting up at 5, which has been inculcated in us. Whether we did it joyously or by force, it's a habit that has formed over a decade, because of which somehow it ensures that we are early to rise. And, you know, as the saying goes, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy and wealthy and wise. But this Suprabhatam practice has ensured that even if we are late to bed, we are relatively early to rise.
And absolutely. In fact, the stanza that we are going to go through today reminds me of what the description that people would give of old Mandir. you know, we've spoken a lot about it, Pathamandir days, when Swami used to sleep in the courtyard and everybody used to sleep around. And going back to that Anandadayi book, one of the complaints that most of those people who came in that time had was there was hardly an ashram atmosphere. There was hardly any sadhana. There was no meditation. Right. There was no schedule. There was no discipline. Right? And the reason why it was like that was the idea of any sadhana or discipline is to draw your mind towards God.
Mm.
And he was there and he was doing it.
He was the center of all the activity.
Their mind was focused on them and it did not call for any separate sadhana. And very interestingly, the time when all of these schedules that we follow in the ashram today started taking form was when Swami would travel for long days and these devotees would stay in the ashram.
Right.
Right. And Swami would say that, you know, you have to keep yourself occupied.
Mm.
And if you look at it that way, all of these disciplines have come to replace that focus the physical form brings.
Mm.
And I think that's a very, very important point for all of us. You know, some form of discipline is necessary for us to keep ourselves focused on Swami. And that's why the next stanza that we're going to go through is also from a pre-period of that time, that memory, which we'll talk about probably after we listen to the stanza itself. We'll discuss a short, give you the short meaning of that, and then we'll discuss about that stanza.
Sita sati samabhishuddha hridam bhujata bahvangana kalagrihita supushpahara stunvanti divyanutibhi manibhushanantva Satya Sai Bhagavan Tava Suprabhata.
So that is the eighth stanza, and the meaning of that particular verse is women devotees whose hearts are unattached to the world like lotus petals and are similar to Mother Sita in virtues and piousness are singing thy glory. The glory of Lord Shiva adorned with serpent around his neck through holy hymns holding excellent flower garlands in their hands. O Lord Satyasai, blessed be thy wakefulness. We pray for an auspicious day.
You know, throughout the description of the Suprabhatam, we have been going back and forth on how the Suprabhatam has a physical meaning as well as a metaphysical meaning. And once again, this stanza too is rich with both these meanings. So if we look at the metaphysical meaning, we had discussed how the previous four stanzas referred to the manas, the chitta, the buddhi and the ahankara, or the identification. And that's why we had people desirous of worship, you know, karma, that also. Yeah, the five stanzas starting from Tvannama Kirtana. Those who want to do action, then those who are attracted from the mind level, that is the manas level, then the buddhi level. We had Deshantaragata Buddhastava Divyanam Divyamurtim. Now we come to the, you know, penultimate state. After that stage is the ultimate merger, and this, that is why it is not surprising that it speaks of three people like Sita and Sati. I mean, for any devotee it would be the greatest aspiration to consider the Lord the way Sita considers Rama, the way Radha considers Krishna. They are inseparable. In fact, that is how even Parvati and Parameshwara are worshipped. It is said, Vagartha viva sampraktav, Vagartha pratipattaye, Jagatah pitarav vande Parvati Parameshwarav. Meaning, they praise Parvati and Parameshwara as inseparable as the word and its meaning. How you can't separate a word from its meaning. When you say the word, the meaning is evident, and if that meaning is understood, the word pops up in the mind. That is how Shiva and Parvati are, and that is why it shows the penultimate stage before the Advaitic stage. This aspect of this androgynous nature where you have Parameshwara and Prakriti. So this is the penultimate stanza. After that, we will see it as the concluding and Falashruti stanzas. But in this penultimate stanza, we have the penultimate stage of nearness and dearness to the Lord. So that is the metaphysical meaning. Of course, the physical, as you referred to already, Prem, is what I think Sri Tirumalachar saw with his own eyes happening in the Mandir, and what all of us have also witnessed, where it was literally the women devoted and with great love for Bhagwan, who would rise up even before the Brahma Muhurtam to get the whole place ready for the devotees, for the Bhagwan, for Bhagwan and for Bhaktas. So that is being referred to in this stanza.
And in fact, even before the scene of the women waking up and getting the place ready, the story goes that, you know, they were all, it was a time when Swami was in Pathamandir, and Swami used to be the first one to wake up. And he would boil water, he would have bath, and he would keep some more water for boiling for the others. And then he would start cleaning the altar, he would start wiping the photographs. And
his own.
Right, his own altar. And it so happened that some of the women noticed this. And they felt that, you know, here is the Lord, we have come to worship, and he's doing all of this. So they had to get up earlier than him and start doing all of these things. And that's how they started waking up, you know, much before even the Brahma Murtam and doing it. And that's when Tirumalachar sees this, and then he writes about it. And I remember, even I think when we were in Vrindavan, whether Swami is in Parthi or in Vrindavan, there would always be these women devotees who come so early in the morning to clean Ramesh Hall and put rangolis all around Trai Vrindavan. And I still recall one day when we were sitting in Swami's presence in Trai Vrindavan, I think Swami started the conversation referring to some of these lady devotees who come and work. And the warden who was there, he said, yes, Swami, they come at 2:30, 3 in the morning. And some of them come from quite a distance. They don't even stay very close to the ashram.
Which means they must be waking up at 1:32.
And they were doing it every day. Right, there was I think Samiti in Beltur. I think people used to come from there, and the warden was telling Swami they come without a break, and I've seen them for so many years coming. And Swami saying that time, Swami very clearly told all of us, we were all sitting in front of Swami. Swami said, the devotion that women have, men will never have it. Right? Mm-hmm. Swami said, and these are examples for that. Really, so when Swami is saying your Sita Sati, they really had. The other very beautiful incident which comes to my mind is when, again in the olden days, they used to have this tradition of Sumangali Puja. Right? Swami used to allow the devotees who had come to worship in all the forms they were used to. So be it Pada Puja like we spoke about the last week. The Sumangali Puja was again a tradition where all the married women would come and worship the Lord, praying for their husband's long life and all that. So they had arranged for the Sumangali Puja once, and Swami said, oh, all right, and he was sitting on the throne, they all came. And when they all came with all the paraphernalia to do the worship, Swami found that there were some people missing, you know, a very small crowd. So Swami knew exactly the number of women devotees were there, and Swami said, some of them are missing. So one of the devotees came up to Swami and said, but Swami, their husbands are not alive anymore. Mm. And their widows, and generally in Indian tradition, they follow this very strictly. They don't come forward when some event like this is happening. So all of these women had gone to another room and they didn't want to come to Swami's presence. And Swami said, no, call all of them. Mm. And they were all brought to Swami's presence. And Swami said, why are you not coming? Why are you not doing this worship? So they said, Swami, this is Sumangali Puja. We should not come. Mm. Then Swami said, see, when you have installed me in your heart, how can you be an Amangali? Swami said, see, Sumangali is one who worships a pati. I have become the master in your heart. As long as I am in your heart, how can you be Amangali? You are all Sumangalis. And he made all of them participate and do in that worship. So when Swami says Sita Sati, devotees who had accepted him as their Lord, and that was their chastity. It is not the regular, devotion worldly to the husband that we are talking of. It is what the Supreme Swami would in fact say, the devotion of a true devotee is like the pativrata nature of a married woman. That kind of one-pointed focus is what devotion is.
In fact, the word pati, which refers to husband, also means the Lord. Actually, it means the Lord. That's why the Lord is called Jagatpati, meaning he is the, if you take the literal translation, it means he is the husband to the whole world. But that's what it is, pati. I remember another discourse where, you know, Swami was saying, you can't refer to anybody in the world as anatha. Anatha loosely is translated as orphan. But if you go into the inner meaning, anatha means one who has no lord. So a child who has lost the parents is said like not having anybody to take care, therefore it's an anatha. But Swami said, no, God is there. As long as God is there, how can anybody be an anatha? And Swami further elaborated saying that if at all there's an anatha, it is the Lord himself. Because he doesn't have an anatha above him. So the Lord is the only anatha in this universe. Nobody's an anatha. And I think these kinds of beautiful meanings and inner significances, only, you know, Swami can provide. And it is so beautiful. I mean, just imagine how those people would have felt, those ladies who felt that we are Amangali. I mean, Amangali literally translates into a person who brings inauspiciousness. And Swami said, once you have attached yourself to the Lord, how can anything be inauspicious? It's all auspicious only. In fact, you already gave a kind of a teaser to the next stanza, because the concluding stanza of the Suprabhatam is all about Mangalam only, saying that once you begin the day with Satya Sai, once you begin it with the Lord, everything is bound to be auspicious. And it is natural that, I mean, it is being spoken. Another line that is being spoken in this Sita Sati Sama Vishuddha is the aspect which describes these women as being pure like the lotus. I think that's very, very significant.
Yeah, Hridambu means the heart is like the lotus, which is not attached to the water from which it has grown, which Swami would often say. There's also a very interesting, take from this, which I remembered from the 1990 series. Swami, first thing is that Swami would say everybody is three. Everybody is a woman, and we all are, having that feminine aspect. Only God is Purusha, that is one. And how to become pure? In that 1990 series, Swami says, anybody who has control over their senses is a gopi. That's what Swami has said. A gopi is one who has had control over senses. So here is a Sita Sati Sama Vishuddha Hridam Pujata. Means they're not attached to the world and the senses, the world of senses. They have grown beyond the world of senses. And with that purity, they are worshipping you. So
that is how Swami would describe a lotus as well. He would say the lotus is in the mud, but it is not of the mud. Right. I mean, Swami would say that in Hindi, in Sanskrit, it's also called Pankaja. Pankaja means one that is born from Panka. Panka means all this slush and mud. So Swami would say that a lotus is there in the slush and mud, but not, it is untouched by that slush and mud. That's how you should live in the world. The world is there with its maya and worldliness, but you should be untouched by it. Put a drop of water on the lotus petal or the leaf and you'll see how it just slides away without wetting the lotus. So too Swami would say that though this worldly rasa is there, it should not penetrate into you. It should not enter you. You live in the world. You be in the world. Let the world not be in you. That is how Swami would say. And it's so beautiful. I think it's very, very symbolic and meaningful that the author has explicitly stated that these women are coming with offerings of lotus garlands and lotus flowers, because the lotus is a very, very special flower in that sense.
And even speaking of it, in the literal sense, even today I think the duty continues of garland making. A lot of these elderly women of the ashram congregate in a place next to the mandir and make garlands for Swami's throne, for all the arrangements in the mandir. And that's the beauty. Whether you're doing this in any temple, you're talking about Suprabhatam for the different deities in different forms. You could be doing this in Tirupati, you could be doing this in Dwarka, you could be doing it in any temple. Wherever you do it as an offering to God, God accepts it. But it is when He comes in the human form, you see Him actually relish it. Right? I recall so many times, especially in the later years when Swami used to come in the car around, He would so much focus on that Rangoli which is there, between the old students block and before Swami turns towards
the east, right, Prashanti side of
towards
the
east Prashanti side, they would have a elaborate Rangoli over there. And so many days, there were days when we used to curse because instead of looking at us, Swami would be looking down at the garland, at the Rangoli. But it used to be so beautiful that, they are doing it for Swami, and those few seconds that Swami is spending looking at it. And so many times Swami would come, enter into the bhajan hall, and He would stop and look at that the garland they put on the frame of the wall, on the door.
Right.
You know, very beautiful decoration they used to make. Swami would stop there and admire that. You know, it would be so beautifully done. And in fact, some of the ladies who actually till very recently also used to participate in that garland making, they would say in the earlier years, Swami used to come and participate in the garland making. And they were all very elderly to Swami, almost like, you know, Swami's mother's age. So they used to say, Swami, you're disturbing our work, please go away. Go and do something which you are good at, like leave this to us.
You know, while we are on the topic of flowers, let me just complete my eulogy to the lotus. Yeah. Because, you know, a lotus, if you see, it is not as if it's very fragrant. I mean, there are many more flowers which are so fragrant and awesome, you know. Take the rose or the chrysanthemum or the jasmine. But still, if we look at all our bhajans or all our praises to the Lord, it's only the lotus that we see, the lotus feet, Kamala Nayana, his eyes are compared to the lotus, his face is compared to the lotus.
By the way, Arvind is also a lotus.
Oh. Wow, I'm very flattered now. But that is the speciality of the lotus, because I think more than appearing colorful, more than being very fragrant, the most important property is that it doesn't allow the world to seep into it, that detachment. And when we look either at the Bhagavad Gita or even Swami's discourses, it is very clear that the one who is dear to Swami is one who has detachment. It's a virtue that is held like a crest jewel. And therefore, I think that the lotus has been given such a spot, though it is not the most vibrant flower, though it is not the most fragrant flower, though it is not the most easily accessible flower, though it's not the most exotic flower, simply because it represents detachment, it has won such a place at the Lord's feet, that the Lord's feet is compared to the lotus, his face is compared to the lotus, his eyes are compared to the lotus. I mean, even if we look at our own Indian scriptures, we see Lord Brahma seated on the lotus, we see Mother Saraswati seated on the lotus, we see the lotus in the hand of Vishnu and many, many goddesses. So it is definitely a very symbolic and meaningful statement in this stanza, which says that women whose hearts are like the lotus are offering the lotus to the Lord. And to which Lord? Again, Swami is referred to as Lord Shiva. Because Fani Bhushanam Tvam, the Lord who is decorated with the Fani meaning snake, that is Lord Shiva. Again, an epitome or an embodiment of detachment.
Right.
And this Fani Bhushanam Tvam, I think also because in those days, which we are speaking of the Pathamandiram days, like Swami used to get up in the morning and do all the chores, he also was the first priest of his own mandir. He used to do the aarti till, of course, Mr. Sheshagiri Rao arrived. And I'm sure when Tirumalachar came to Swami, Sheshagiri Rao was there. And Sheshagiri Rao arrived because he saw Swami as the Fani Bhushanam, right?
Right. I mean, we've narrated that incident many times where he is that very staunch Lord Shiva devotee. And he, in fact, tells his daughters who want to come and see Swami, he says that, you know, I am a worshipper of Lord Shiva. I will not come and fall at the feet of a Kshatriya boy, a 16-year-old Kshatriya boy, and who lives in some village. So they tell him, it's okay, you don't have to come and fall, but we need a male escort. So you come along with us. And so he says, I'll come, but I will not come and see him. In fact, they had some relatives in Puttaparthi, it seems, apparently. So he said, I'll stay with them. You go and, do whatever foolishness that you want to get indulge in and come back. And having come so far, you know, it's a horrible journey, to say the least, 1940s. And all through he's cursing them. He said, where have you brought me? And, you know, do you have to really travel so far to see, have the vision of such a boy and all of that? And having gone through that, you know, probably that journey would have been so arduous that he thought that, having come so far, let me just see who this fellow is. And eventually that's what happens. He says he comes, he has one glance at Swami and he swoons in a faint.
And, for a couple of days.
Right. And I mean, they say that even the daughters are shocked because they are not very old devotees of Swami. Even they are coming for the first time. And very casually Swami comes and gives him some vibhuti and he says...
And if you picture that scene, Prem, you know, it's like Pathamandir. We have seen how it is. It's so small. Swami
I think
seated
this was
for bhajans.
Even before the Pathamandir came. I think Swami was still in Subhama's house.
Kanam Subhama's house.
So it must have been like, you know, maybe about 20-25 people doing bhajans there. These people are also there. And he peeps from the behind, and in middle of the bhajan, they hear a thud and this person has fallen. It must have been a very...
Dramatic
and shocking thing also, because yes. I don't think there were medical facilities available anywhere nearby. Absolutely. If they want to take him.
In fact, that's what they say. Swami was the most calm person in the whole thing. And very casually he said, don't worry, he's all right, but he'll take 2 days to wake up. So Swami instructed them that you put him in my room. I will take care of him. And every few hours, Swami would go into the room, materialize Vibhuti and put it in his mouth. And after 2 days, eventually he wakes up and he calls his daughters and he tells them that, okay, you can carry on. You can go back to Bangalore. I will not be able to come with you. And they were shocked because he was still in service. He had not even retired from the government job that he was doing. So he said, no, I'm not coming back with you. You all can go and I'm staying here. They asked, what happened? Mm. Why did you faint and what happened? And then he says, I've worshipped him for 50 years. Mm. And when I peeped and I saw him, I saw, you know, the same description he gives. I saw the moon on his locks. I saw the snake around his neck. I saw the Ganga
Ganges
flowing from his head. Am I so foolish to leave him after, you know, after having worshipped him for 50 years? I finally find him. Will I leave him and go?
He never went back after
right,
that.
He never goes back. Oh. Only when Swami used to go to Bangalore, he used to go with Swami.
With his Shiva.
Right.
And I think Shiva is so close to our hearts, because if you were to ask me to name the most solemn and most, you know, energetic, there's a kind of mystery in the air kind of festival in Prashanthi Nilayam, right on top of the list will be Shivratri. Of course, made so, what can I say, auspicious and holy and filled with ardor and fervor because of the Vibhuti Abhishekam that Swami would do to the Shirdi Baba silver idol, or the Lingodbhavam that Swami would do. In fact, speaking of Lingodbhavam, it reminds me of the other episode where when the Patamandir was being built, there was this Guni Venkata, meaning the hunchback Venkata, who was digging for the foundation.
Right.
And they found multiple peethams, or the base on which the Shivlinga rests. But it was surprising because all of them were only peetams and there were no lingams on it. And when this was brought to Swami's notice, Swami was very casual, as if he expected it to be like that. Then they asked, Swami, where are the lingams? Swami, pointing to his stomach, said, they're all here. At that time, it might have been a very cryptic gesture. But within a few years after that, when Swami started doing the Lingodbhavam, I think everyone realized the significance of that simple statement that Swami had made years back.
Right. And that is the beauty of this particular verse. So many important things being mentioned. You know, when Swami says you can be a devotee like Sita, it is by saying, in fact, I was reading this small piece in a discourse where Swami is saying about that very famous incident from the Ramayana where Hanuman offers to take Sita back.
Right. That was coming to my mind. Yes.
He says, I will take you back. Because, you know, here is a devotee who has crossed the oceans and come, and he has established his devotion.
Right.
In front of Mother Sita, he has shown what a devotee he is.
And also he has that proof of the ring.
Right. And then he says that, you know, Mother, I cannot see you suffering like this. I will take you back. Because he sees the sight of Ravana coming and, you know, troubling her. He says, you come right away, I'll take you back. Imagine, the Swami writes that Sita did not want anything as much as she wanted to go back to Rama.
Mm.
And here was an opportunity. But she said, no, I want to go back to Rama, but he should come and take me. Right? And Swami said that is what a Pativrata is, and that is how a devotee should be. There should be yearning for the Lord, but that firmness that the Lord should come in. I will not have anybody else taking me to the Lord, anybody else coming in between me and my Lord. My Lord should come and take me, and I'm ready to wait till then. Whatever suffering is there, I'm ready to undergo it, but he should come. Right?
I think that should be etched in all our hearts, especially in these times when the intermediary business is booming. Because, you know, Swami would so emphatically state it, even in form of that Telugu shloka, which I am not able to quote in Telugu, but the English meaning was, a true devotee's determination should be such that he should seek from the Lord and Lord alone, and seek in such a manner that either the Lord should come and grant your wish, or you should collapse in that effort. I mean, you should not be satisfied with anything else. Don't be satisfied with second best or third best. somebody else coming in the form and giving that, no, the Lord, you come and give me. Otherwise, I will collapse with the effort, no problem. Swami said, these should be the only two end results. Either you have collapsed because of your effort, or the Lord has manifested before you. You should not give up determination. This is the kind of determination that's expected from a devotee.
In fact, the whole idea of the lotus and the lotus garlands offering to the Lord, because if you see the iconography, like where you see Lord Vishnu, the patram push, the chakra, shankha chakra, gada, pani, that Padma. Flower, Padma, what he's using, that he's holding is actually symbolic of the devotee's heart. So it's the devotee's heart which is represented as the lotus. So that's possibly another interpretation of the Padma, of the lotus, where you are with a pure heart. Now, what is Sita? What is Gopi? Like a heart which is gone beyond the pulls of the senses. And so such a pure heart you're offering to the Lord. So you become a Sita from a normal prakriti, a person, when you have purified your heart. And that pure heart you're offering to the Lord.
On that note, dear listeners, we will take a quick little break here. On the other side of the break, we will head towards the Falashruti of the Suprabhatam, or in marketing terms, the promised reward if you do the Suprabhatam regularly, which all of us need. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back very soon.
Namo Sai Deva Jaya Jaya Namo Prema Bhava.
Let's see.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are in the last paragraph of the Suprabhatam, and we spoke about the stanza number 8, where Swami makes a reference to, Tirumalachar makes a reference to the women who used to wake up early in the morning and get the mandir ready for Swami to wake up. And in fact, talking about these early mornings and Swami waking up early, I think you were talking about the Vrindavan days when the hostel used to be in the car shed.
Right.
Many days Swami would land up inside at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, okay.
And Swami would catch the boys sleeping after Suprabhatam. Swami would say that, hey, fellows, you're supposed to wake up with Suprabhatam. So the idea of waking up Swami for Suprabhatam is a, you know. Should we go to the last paragraph? Or?
Yes, yeah. I think we'll go to the ninth one. It's again so significant that there are 9 stanzas. So sometimes people consider these as 2 different stanzas, but if we go by the length of the lines in the other stanzas, we realize that this is almost just like one concluding. And this is the Falashruti. Before we just play the stanza and hear the meaning, I think a few minutes on the Falashruti. If we look at any of the stotrams or ashtakams or dashakams or whatever, every thing ends with a Falashruti, even if we look at the Lingashtakam. You know, Yappate Shiva Sannidhau, Shiva Lokam Avapnoti, Shivena Sahamodate. It says that whoever chants Lingashtakam sincerely, with all heart, with all purity, and etc., etc., you will attain Shiva Loka and you will get all these. So it's almost like in the Kali Yuga, especially in the Kali Yuga, everything is result oriented. Even, you know, when we go for purchasing anything, or whether we wish to go to enroll in a school or any place, we want to know what is the result that I am going to get. So, usually the Falashruti is placed at the end, and at the end of the Suprabhatam also we have a kind of a Falashruti, which basically says that if you are sincere and if you do this regularly, if you are sincere and regular in Suprabhatam, what are the rewards you will enjoy? It is like an incentive. I mean, if till now the Suprabhatam hasn't impressed you, well, listen to this and you will start hopefully doing the Suprabhatam from tomorrow onwards. So this is the Falashruti stanza, the Mangalam stanza, the concluding stanza of the Suprabhatam. We'll hear it and then have a discussion on that.
Suprabhatam idam punyam ye pathanti dine dine te vishanti parandhama jnana vijnana sho.
So this is the ninth stanza. I think we've cut the last part separately, so we'll take it part by part. So this is the first part of the Falashruti, the meaning of which is whoever daily recites this morning awakening hymn will attain the highest abode, resplendent with supreme intelligence as well as supreme wisdom.
It says, Suprabhatam idam punyam. I mean, this punyam, the merit that you attain by Suprabhatam, and not by just chanting it as a one-off or suddenly out of josh on Swami's birthday you chant it. It's not like that. Ye patanti dine dine, on a daily basis. Those who chant this on a daily basis, te vishanti parandhama, they will attain the paramdhama, the highest abode, the ultimate abode. Jnana vijnana shobita, decorated with jnana and vijnana. I mean, it's very interesting that they have made use of both the words. Is it simply to attain a meter or match by getting a rhyming, a sense of rhyming by telling Jnana Vijnana? No, these words have great inner meaning, and I think the crux of the Suprabhatam lies in this combo of Jnana and Vijnana. So if we do the Suprabhatam regularly, sincerely, on a daily basis, we are promised the Paramdhama and we are promised Jnana Vijnana.
Before we probably discuss about Jnana Vijnana, you know, talking about Falashruti, and you were saying, oftentimes when I used to listen to all these stotrams and that Falashruti comes, one thing is the reward, the other thing is the confidence of the person who has written it, right? The confidence to say that this will accrue, this will be rewarded to you if you do it. And it is not confidence in his work. It is the confidence in the Lord, saying that, you know, if you worship Lord like that, I think even in the Hanuman Chalisa, it comes towards the end, you know, you will get this, you will be protected. And that can come only if, you know, if you know the Lord really well. Many times, I don't know, it's not out of really arrogance or the idea that we know Swami, but we can absolutely say with confidence that, no, if you are sincere, if you pray, Swami will come to you. Right? Because we have seen so many times that happening, that there needs to be, like, from out of the blue. In fact, once when Swami was speaking, Anil Kumar sir was speaking to some group, I think I heard it in his talk, where he says there was this group of ladies who came from Japan, and it was quite not very early also, probably in the late 90s or even in the early 2000s. They just heard about Swami, they formed a group, they come all the way. And that was a time when Swami was not really giving interviews to devotees. You know, unless you're part of some group, you come as a retreat or something like that. These people are not part of the organization. They just, you know, formed a group and came here. And they thought that we'll come to Parthi and Swami will speak to us.
Mm.
Right? So the inquiries they made after coming to Parthi also, like, where should we sit? And, you know, how do we ask Swami to speak to us?
Mm.
And those devotees like us, you know, who've been here for so long, you know, they would have told them, no, it's not so easy. Mm. You cannot come and simply ask for Swami to speak to you. And they were disappointed. They thought that, no, because we thought that the Lord is there in the human form and this is the opportunity for us to speak to him. Right? And they, of course, were joined the token line. They were sitting there. The first darshan they're sitting, Swami comes straight to them, picks the whole group, sends them for an interview and speaks to them. And all of us were surprised because for a long, long time, Swami had not given a group interview like that.
Mm.
Right? So there is nothing like, this will not happen, this is over, this, you know, this opportunity is not there. We've seen any number of times Swami reaching out to very, very, you know, people whom we do not think will get that chance, and Swami giving out. I think that is the confidence of Falashruti stands for.
And also, you know, when you were saying, Prem, that it's not as if we are, you know, we are totally in touch with Swami and we are great. It's not like that. Sometimes it's the desperateness of the situation. I remember in 2013, a couple of, you know, brother Amay and myself, we were in Trinidad, and there we were attending bhajans and a satsang in a center, and we were introduced to a couple who have actually donated that center. I mean, it's their home, and the large part of their home, 70% of the home, which is on the ground floor, has been offered to Swami as a center. That is a Satsai center there. And they're living above. And the host somehow had not come for the bhajan and satsang. And we were told that the host would like to meet us. So when we went and met them, we found out the reason why they hadn't come. It was because this lady had been yearning to have a child from a long time. Finally, after years, she was blessed with a child. But unfortunately, because of some complications in the delivery, she had suffered a lot of blood loss. And the child had, you know, was stillborn, it died at birth. And she was in trauma, you know, mental trauma. And the devotees around also, you know, they had this question as to, she has done so much for Swami, why is Swami doing this to her? And it was a very uncomfortable situation. We didn't know what answer to give. And this lady was just weeping. And the other people around, you know, said, if you can just comfort her or do something, it'll be great. At such moment, I think both Brother Amay and myself, we connected to Swami out of desperateness. We had no idea what. And we had absolutely no control over what was coming out from our mouth. And we just said, you know, we both handed her a packet of vibhuti and said, you take this vibhuti on a regular basis and pray to Swami. Within a month's time, you will feel better. It will all get all right. You know, I don't know why we gave that timeline of a month or something like that, but we said it, you know, we just said, take this, like a doctor gives a prescription and tells that within 2 weeks you should be fine. We gave a vibhuti prescription and told within a month you'll be fine. Sure enough, unbelievably, within a month she actually messaged us. She wrote to us saying that she's feeling so much better, she's feeling strong, she's feeling grateful to Swami. And both of us really wondered, what was it that made her grateful to Swami or whatever. Again, within a few months, you know, 9 months to be precise, she writes telling that she is now mother to a girl.
Hmm.
And 2 years after that, she writes once more telling that she has got her second child.
Hmm.
And now I'm just thinking that 1 month later, the relief she found must have been that she must have tested positive for the child. That's why she must have said whatever. But the beautiful thing is when you give a Phalashruti, it comes, I think, in even if you are not connected 24/7 with Swami, there are those beautiful experiences when you feel the connect, and it is actually the divine confidence that is flowing through. It is not that, it is not as if it is your assurance or your guarantee. It is a divine guarantee that you just happened to connect with and you just shared it. And that, I think, has happened even with Tirumalachar Garu when he is given this as the Phalashruti, telling that you just do the Suprabhatam, you will attain Jnana and Vijnana.
The another important aspect of this is Ye Patanti Dine Dine. So the whole idea of doing something repeatedly, and Swami, he has even mentioned that in Dhyana Vahini, etc., where he says, choose one place, don't change your location. Choose that one location and constantly every day do your spiritual practice in that one location, because then this place is charged. You know, there's a very interesting story about the Raja of Venkatagiri. Raja of Venkatagiri, he had this practice of doing the puja for Lord Rama every day. At that given time, at that given this thing, he would do his puja irrespective of where he was. So, where if he was in Venkatagiri, he would do it in his room. We have visited that room. It's like a narrow corridor. Small room it is. And he would do his puja every day. But if he's traveling, he would make sure that his flights do not, his schedule does not come in the way of his puja. So he has fixed the time in the day for puja and he would stick to it no matter what. So every day he would do puja at that time. Now the crowning glory of all his effort was when Swami visited Venkatagiri. And at that time, now he was in a dilemma because Swami is here, but he has to do his puja. Now what to do? Because there was a conflict, not a conflict, but he didn't know what to do. And so when Swami went to the courtyard, quadrangle, and Swami was just giving darshan, he said, I'll quickly go and do my puja now. So anyway, Swami is turning that side. So he ran up to his puja room and he sat and he was doing his puja. And that is when Swami, he heard a voice calling him, hey, or something. Swami called his name or Swami just made a sound. When he turned back, he had darshan of Lord Rama.
Wow, that is the legendary story that we hear about of him having, yes, Rama Darshan.
Yes.
In fact, when you said this, I remembered that to even our own colleague, you know, Arvind Sai, there was a period when on a regular basis, Swami used to speak with him. So on in such situations, you know, we call it as the form boy stage. When you're in form, you need to inform Swami or take permission for every little thing you do because he's looking out for you. So he had to go for his dental treatment to Anantpur. So he said, Swami, tomorrow I won't be there for bhajans. I won't be doing bhajans. So Swami said, why? He said, because Swami, I have to go to Anantpur. Swami said, so why can't you do bhajans then? He said, Swami, because at bhajan time at 5:30, I'll be in the train. I will not be at Puttaparthi. Then Swami said, who said you have to be here to do bhajans? At that time, you close your eyes, think of me and sing bhajan wherever you are, in the train itself, and I will be there and I'll receive your offering. I mean, so when you say that a fixed time, a fixed place,
yes,
Swami definitely encouraged it, and he encouraged it simply because it definitely has a very, very beneficial effect on the sadhaka. It helps in ways which we cannot imagine. It is better that we just follow it, stick to the same place, stick to the same timing. In fact, going ahead, taking this a little ahead, I remember how our warden, when we used to prepare for convocation dramas, used to tell that you can play and practice, not play, I mean, you can practice your roles, practice different things in different places, scene by scene or whatever. But 6 o'clock to 7 o'clock, we will have a combined practice. Combined practice meaning all the scenes will be played out like how it will be done in the drama. So it felt a little strange in the beginning because we felt, you know, we have not yet comfortable with our scenes. We don't know the dialogues yet. Let us practice more and we'll come back for this combined practice for the last 3-4 days maybe. But from day one, you know, if it means holding the paper and speaking, hold and speak. If you mean you don't know the roles, no problem. But 6 to 7 we have to do this. And later he said that this was suggested by Swami himself, this technique, because final day it is on the 22nd of November between 6 to 7 that you will be doing presenting the convocation drama. So if you do this regularly, it will happen that on that day, automatically at that time, you will get into your role, you will be in that correct mood, everything will fall in place. So amazing. Even for a drama, if it is true, what to say about this drama called life?
Right. So, you know, then going on to the second part of this paragraph, of course, the words jnana vijnana, and there is a difference between the two words, and of course, one interpretation of vijnana is also scientific knowledge, etc. But there is also a deeper spiritual connotation to that, and
In this context, vijnana is the spiritual higher wisdom.
Yeah. Yes. So, you know, what I did was, to be very frank, I googled the meaning of jnana and vijnana, and Google suggested a paragraph from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, today in the day of shortcuts, so I went to the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna and came across this very beautiful explanation he has given.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened on 5th of August 1882.
Okay.
And that's when Ramakrishna Paramahamsa speaks to M, the author of Gospel, and he says, I want to meet Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar. And he's been asking him, I want to meet him.
Oh, by the way, for our listeners, Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar was a great social reformer, a great spiritual being in India. In fact, Swami often quotes his name for humility and also says that just like Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar fulfilled his mother's wishes to build a small dispensary and a small school.
Right.
In a similar manner, Swami also did fulfilling his mother Ishwaramma's wishes.
Yes. In fact, it's very interesting. The small write-up they give about Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar in the Gospel is exactly what you just said. And also, things like when they asked him about God. It was very interesting when they asked him about God. He said, you cannot see God or you cannot, you know, but our every action that we do should be an offering of love, or it should be an offering. It should be, it should be like we are offering it to the holiest person or something on those lines. So, but the interesting part was this conversation. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa is like a child. He is very excited to go and meet Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar. And on the way, he asks him, see, my button has come out. Will he be offended by that? And he says, no, nothing. Because M is a teacher in the Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar school.
Okay.
So he's teaching there. So he says, because, you know, I am then very excited. He goes there and there's a table laid out, and Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar is sitting there, and the master Ramakrishna Paramahamsa goes there and he says, I was going around looking at rivers and lakes and ponds. Finally, I've come to the ocean.
Sagar means
the
ocean.
Sagar. I've come to the Sagar, the ocean. Then Ishwarchandra Vidyasagar says, so then you'll be going back with a sack of salt. And he says,
that's humility of them.
He says, no, this is not salt. This is nectar. And he says, although your activities are rajasic, the comment is very beautiful, very powerful. He says, your activities of education, all this is, but it is prompted by sattvic, by compassion. It is prompted by that sattvic nature of yours and that compassion. So everything is sanctified. And then he goes on to explain the difference between a jnani and a vijnani.
Mm-hmm.
So in the course of the conversation,
Ramakrishna
Paramahamsa. Uh-huh. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, he starts by saying that, you know, we are aware. There are people who have knowledge. There are people who have understood, like our ancients. They have, you know, spent their entire lifetimes in understanding what Brahman is. So what, that there is Brahman, there is a way of life that we are leading today, and there is Brahman, who is the essence of everything that we see. So that is as far as a jnani gets. So he says, it's like climbing stairs. So he says, a jnani is climbing stairs. You're climbing stairs to reach the roof. And that roof is a level of understanding. But where does the vijnani comes? He says, a vijnani is one who knows that even the stairs are made up of the same material. The analogy is so beautiful. He says, the Jnani knows the reality that there is Brahman, there is the world which is not real, and so he's aware of the duality. The Vijnani knows that even the small ego that is present in each of you, the impurities, the world, the creation, everything is Brahman. He lives in that experience. He lives in that experience that everything is Brahman. And so, basically, the difference between a Jnani and Vijnani, again, he says is, like he says, for example, if there is a Jnani, the characteristics of a Jnani is one who is very peaceful in nature. His nature is very peaceful and is very composed and poised and has no ego at all. That is a Jnani. And he says, a Vijnani, like for example, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he says, a person like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, at sometimes he's like a child. Then sometimes he is like a madman. Sometimes he is like an inert creature. So in that, they are completely in that moment. They don't have one nature. So in the sense that they manifest themselves as everything that you see around. So Vijnani, I was just thinking about when he was talking, describing that. You look at Swami himself. You know, when amongst children I'm a child, when amongst men I'm a man, when amongst women I'm a woman. So, a person who is living that experience, that is a Vijnani. So, here in this Suprabhatam, when they say Jnana Vijnana Shobhita, Jnana is the knowledge of who Brahma is and what the world is and everything. Vijnana is experiencing and living it in your daily life and knowing that even every part of this world is that same Brahman.
Beautiful. And that's the Falashruti saying, Jnana Vijnana Shobhitam.
Right.
Which means you will shine with both Jnana and Vijnana.
And Vijnana.
Right, my God.
Another place, you know, I was also searching for the different meanings of Jnana and Vijnana. Of course, as you said, one place says that Vijnana in one sense means science. But that doesn't come here. But Jnana Vijnana means not just spiritual splendor and success, you will also be successful in the eyes of worldly people as well. Because, you know, I think this is so important for a naive person to know, I mean, for a normal person to know, because it is often considered like, oh, spiritual means that's it. Hmm. Means you are a worldly failure. Hmm. Who says spirituality is a worldly failure? I think Swami Vivekananda was one who challenged that concept. Hmm. And Swami also, I mean, everybody would think, oh, you're going to, even in my own family, as late as 1990s, people thought that, oh, you're sending him away to become a monk. And Swami in a discourse has said, I don't need you to become monks like that. Because what the avatar does is something totally different. And I think this shatters that wrong notion that spirituality means you are absolutely inert. Right. Useless in the world,
yes.
Of no, means you're good for nothing else, so you're professing spirituality. Because I think it comes from a difference in attitude. People think that spiritual life means you have to sacrifice all the worldly things. The moment you bring the word sacrifice, it means that you're giving up something bigger for something small. But a truly spiritual person is one who feels that this is the greatest treasure. This is the greatest wealth that I can have. As it is recorded in that autobiography of a yogi, when they go to Bahaduri Mahashai, who actually had inherited a lot of property and in one day or one week just gave it all up for the quest of God. They tell him, you are a great Tyagi, you are a great renunciant, you have given up great wealth for the sake of God. He says, no, my dear, you are reversing the case. I gave up a few paltry rupees for a cosmic empire of infinite bliss. You are giving up that cosmic empire for those same rupees and trinkets. You are all the Tyagis and I bow down to you. So, a truly spiritual person doesn't feel that he or she is making a sacrifice. It is not a sacrifice, it's an investment, because I'm giving up something tiny for something so infinite. So,
the same point, in fact, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa also elaborates in that same gospel. He says, if there was an aristocrat, if there is a person, very rich, a wealthy person, who has given up all his riches and who doesn't have anything in his possession, will he still be considered rich? So in the same way, God has all these Aishwaryas, Sakala Aishwarya, six Aishwaryas, he describes them. He says, he's endowed with these six Aishwaryas. And so those Aishwaryas are manifested in this creation. So God to be God is having this Aishwarya. So you cannot say that because he's having this Aishwaryas, he's, because you recognize these Aishwaryas, you are not recognizing his true nature. So a Vigyani is one who recognizes God with all these Aishwaryas. He recognizes God as the manifestation of human beings, as a manifestation of nature, as a manifestation of every event that happens in life. So he says it's like that.
But one more way of probably looking at it is usually, you know, when you say Vijnana, the prefix V, whenever it is used in Sanskrit, it is meant to, I think, to cut or to separate. Right?
Okay.
That's where it comes in Viveka. Mm. And wherever it comes, it is a knowledge which helps you to divide or separate one from the other.
Right.
If you look at it that way, jnana is, Swami says, Advaita Darshanam Jnanam.
Right.
Where you don't see duality, that is jnanam. Mm. But for in everyday life, you need to differentiate between good and bad, right and wrong.
Mm.
And Swami would say, that is also important. And if you look at it that way, vijnana is that knowledge which helps you discriminate between right and wrong, good and bad. So you will have jnana, that idea that everything is one. Swami would say, it is like the undercurrent of all your understanding. It is, it cannot... That bhava dvaitam, Swami would use that word.
Right.
You cannot have vishaya dvaitam. It's not possible. You have to treat your mother different from your wife.
Right.
Mm. Right? But you can have bhava dvaitam. You can always have this belief strongly ingrained in your mind that there is no duality. But in your regular living, you always find out what is the most appropriate action to do at that time. So if you look at it that way, it's jnana and vijnana. Both is necessary to lead a happy and peaceful life.
That's what he says. He says, Lord, the Vijnani feels, even the person with ignorance, with ego, that is the Lord playing the role of a person with ignorance, with ego. So for the Vijnani, everything is divine. And he experiences that in every aspect of his life.
Well, I don't know if I get even jnana, it's enough, I feel, for chanting Suprabhatam. But yes, before we run out of time, there's one more stanza, which is the Mangalam stanza or the auspiciousness stanza. We will play that, go to the, there's not much meaning, in the sense it's a very brief meaning, and then conclude our discussion with that stanza.
Mangalam Gurudev.
That stanza is very, very familiar to me.
The bell would ring and you would wake up, is it?
Right. I mean, we shouldn't, as they say, complete disclosure. For many of us, it used to be so very difficult to keep awake during the Suprabhatam, because that ambience was so perfect to, you know, steal another nap after you wake up so early. Because for us who joined Vrindavan, you know, after finishing our schooling, it is a complete change of the pattern in which we used to lead our life, right? Especially your 12th standard, which is considered to be, the beast on your back, if you could put it that way. We're all used to studying till 2 in the night, 3 in the night, and then waking up at breakfast time. And suddenly you go into this Vrindavan hostel where you're supposed to sleep at 10 o'clock and wake up at 5. It's not easy. So this stanza is the stanza we used to wake up at.
It would be our Suprabhatam.
Right. But we mentioned this even when we started, there's such sweetness and melody in the whole Suprabhatam, right? The way it starts and ends compared to the other Suprabhatams, which are pretty racy and have a higher tempo. It's very, very sweet, and somehow it kind of fits with the place of Prashanti Nilayam, you know.
Right.
Swami himself was quite active and bubbling with energy and running about. But there was always a Prashanti about Prashanti Nilayam, right? Yeah. And I think it reflects that whole idea.
And also very interestingly, the last couple of words, which is Satya Saine, I think it is so beautiful and poetic for the Suprabhatam, because the Suprabhatam is about you know, when we see physically, it's about waking up the Lord. And if we see Swami's own definition of Satya Sai, Swami says, who is Satya Sai? Swami says, Satya Sai is Satya Sai, meaning one who rests, one who sleeps. Sai is like Shesha Shayana. Shesha Sai, when we say Lord Vishnu, who is reclining on the serpent bed. So Sai can mean resting. Sai can also mean sleeping, you know, lying down. So Swami defines Satya Sai as one who is sleeping on truth. I think this is so beautiful, because when we say that this is Suprabhatam, is to wake up Swami. Yeah. In that sense, if you want to take, Swami is sleeping. He's sleeping, but where is he sleeping? Satya Sai. He is a Lord who rests on truth always. In fact, this is how Swami said during the 1975 birthday celebrations, the Golden Jubilee birthday celebrations, when Swami said, announced that there is only one God, he is omnipresent, he is Satya Sai. The whole audience breaks into applause and Swami stops them, saying that you are clapping because you think I am referring to this form here. But no, Satya Sai, Satya Sai. Anyone who rests on truth. And just imagine now, if you put that one and two together, it means that there is only one God, he is omnipresent, he is Satya Sai, and Satya Sai means one who rests on truth. It is only truth that is the only God that is there. So I think it's so beautiful that we began the Suprabhatam by telling that the Lord needn't be woken up because he never sleeps. But we conclude the Suprabhatam telling he is the Lord who sleeps on truth. He rests is the Satya Sai, rests on truth.
Before we come back to this, just one point which came to my mind and I didn't want to miss out on that, is when we were interviewing this Veenamma and Vijayamma, they were the singers who sang the Suprabhatam for many years in the mandir. So Vijayamma is the one, and her mother is Veenamma. So they used to call her Veenamma, I don't know her exact name. And Vijaya is her daughter, who used to sing, who had a very melodious voice. And she used to sing the Suprabhatam in the mandir for many years, for nearly two decades, if I'm not mistaken. So the practice of starting Suprabhatam, singing Suprabhatam, started in the mid or late 50s, if I'm not mistaken. And they narrate that Veenamma was the one who has tuned the Suprabhatam. So the words were given by Tirumalachar, who is a Sanskrit scholar from Venkatagiri
Kingdom. Yes.
So he had come and Swami had told Veenamma to tune it. And then she said, Swami, I don't know how to tune it. What will it? And then Swami guided her on the tune. Mm. And she said they were stuck in the first line. Because it is like Kaushalya Supraja Rama. If you take that Suprabhatam. Here, Ishwar Ramba. There are four syllables. Kaushalya is only three. Then they said that in most of the Suprabhatams, it's the first three. So Ishwar Ramba becomes, then Swami actually guides them. And then Swami used to make her chant this Suprabhatam. When she was a young girl, when she was a young girl, Swami came to the bhajan hall and Swami told her to stand up in the middle of the entire crowd and Swami told her, sing. And so she sang the Suprabhatam. And then Swami said, from that day onward, Swami told her to sing it in the mandir.
Wow.
So that's a story I didn't want to forget.
Sorry. Absolutely.
So
very, very important.
Diversion, but
no diversion at all. It's very much there. Yeah. I mean, having spoken in detail about Tirumalachar, it's only right that we give due respect and remember Veenamma, Vijayamma for their contribution of this tune.
Yes.
And yes, the Suprabhatam ends in the last stanza. Multiple times the word Mangalam comes, which means auspicious.
Yes.
The quick translation is, may all auspiciousness be there due to Sri Satya Sai, the teacher divine, the bestower of wisdom and the resident of Puttaparthi. So after the Phalashruti, it's like a concluding prayer made. It's almost like, if we take the physical sense, it's like at the end of the Suprabhatam, the Lord has woken up. And when the Lord wakes up, Swami gets up and Swami says, hey, you're here. What do you want?
In fact, this is exactly what used to happen, I believe. They further narrated that every day in the 50s and 60s, where you have that Rama, Lakshmana, Sita.
In the bhajan hall. On top. That part is accessible from Swami's room.
From Swami's balcony.
Yes.
So there is a small narrow balcony from Swami's room to another room. And I believe when this Suprabhatam would come to end, like this Mangalam Gurudevaya, Swami would peep from there.
From the curtain.
From the curtain. Swami would peep from there. And that is to be the first darshan. Swami used to peep from there and Mangalam Gurudevaya, Mangalam Gyanadayini. At that time, he's actually giving you darshan from there.
And it's a beautiful because it's absolutely a prayer saying that may there be all auspiciousness
right.
from you, O Satya Sai, our divine teacher, our bestower of wisdom, the resident of Puttaparthi.
Beautiful. And I think we probably conclude with that. And even as we are talking about waking up, Swami, I'm reminded of another interview which we did with that elderly devotee from Ooty,
right.
in whose house Swami used to stay.
Matan, right? Lakshmi Matan.
Dr. Matan,
yes,
right,
yes.
From Ooty. So she would say that whenever Swami would come to Ooty and stay in the house, being the lady of the house, she would be the last person to lock all the doors
mm-hmm.
and ensure that Swami is comfortable in his room and keep water for all the guests. And she would latch the door and go and sleep. There are many, many occasions when she'll wake up early in the morning at 4 o'clock to start preparing for Swami. And she would see that Swami is not in his room. The door has not been unlatched, but Swami is not there.
Oh.
And in the middle of the night, not early in the morning. When she gets up early in the morning, she'll find that Swami is back in his room. Right? And she was saying that there was one occasion when she woke up early in the morning and to have some water or something. And in the hall, she found an elderly person sitting down and, you know, reclining on the sofa and sleeping.
Uh-huh.
He had a flowing white beard, wrinkled face, but still so much of tejas on his face. And again, the door was latched. Nobody knows how he came in. But he was sitting in the hall
mm-hmm.
and then she didn't have the guts to go and wake him up and ask who he is. She realized that there's some visitation by a divine being. And later again, when she woke up at 4 in the morning, she found that that person had left. So Swami is not somebody who takes a rest in the night. In fact, probably he becomes more active then.
No, I think at 2 a.m. he must have gone for Suprabhatam at Japan. And as the sun keeps rising across the globe, he also keep traveling because the Suprabhatam is having that, right? Aditya Kantir, just as the sun is rising.
Yeah, yeah.
I think as people are chanting, so Swami keeps also traveling with the sun to different.
Right.
He is the sun who fills our life with radiance, love, light and life.
Beautiful. So I think we'll conclude with that. Thank you, Sai Prakash, for joining. And in fact, we would have missed the most important point of who has tuned the Suprabhatam.
Right.
And luckily we got to mention that at least with the fag end of the discussion. And for many, many devotees, I think now the Suprabhatam has even been translated and very beautifully tuned in English.
Mm-hmm.
Probably as we conclude the Suprabhatam satsang that we've done for the past 4 weeks, we'll end with that rendition of Suprabhatam in English for those devotees who would really love to connect to Swami through that. And thank you, dear listeners, for joining us today and through the entire discussion of the Suprabhatam. As always, we offer this whole effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. And we'll join you all again next week at 12:30 for the next episode of Afternoon Satsang. Jai Sai Ram.
Ishwaram as resplendent sun, it's the start of a bright new day. Time to rise, time to shine, Lord divine. Time to lead us along life's way. Awake, Lord of Puttaparthi. Awake, O Lord. The world good fortune may find. On Chitravati's peaceful shore stands our heart's own mansion. We yearn to serve you and we long for your holy darshan. Morning's begun, and o'er the world spreads the radiant sun. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. We love to sing your holy name with that sweet emotion and taste the pure nectar which comes from our true devotion. Come, shower drops of blessings on us, we pray, gracious one. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. We've brought to you colorful flowers with fragrance so sweet. Our dear Guru, our object now is to worship your feet. Your devotees are gathered into the place where we meet. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. Among the seekers of the world, knowledge that you're here grew. From far and near, people are coming who long to see you. They are reciting Vedic mantras, knowing their value. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. Throughout the earth, people of worth are now singing your name. They know your glory and the sweet story of why you came. Seekers of truth from every land are now singing your name. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. Women demure as Mother Sita now sing in rapture. Like lotus blooms drawn to the light, their hearts are soft and pure. With garlands of sweet flowers, they will adorn your picture. Sri Satya Sai Bhagavan, may your glory now dawn. Whoever sings this waking chant sings it faithfully every day. Great peace to you, the Lord. and the wisdom for which we pray. O auspicious divine teacher, O auspicious all-seer,